Hi, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. My guest is opera singer Beverly Sills. Beverly Sills has described her career as revolutionary because at a time when most singers established themselves by touring Europe, she spent her early career entirely in the United States. Before she became famous, Sills considered giving up performing after the births of her two disabled children. Her daughter is deaf, and her son is mentally retarded. But she resumed singing after a hiatus of several years. Since then, she's performed almost all the major roles in the soprano repertoire in opera houses around the world. At the age of 51, Sills retired from the stage and accepted the position of general director of the New York City Opera. Beverly Sills told me that her love for opera was inspired by her mother.
She was a passionate opera lover. Any extra money that she had, she purchased Gallicorti recordings, which is what I grew up on. When I was 7, I didn't memorize television commercials the way kids do today. I memorized arias. That's all I heard morning, noon, and night. She cranked up the Victrola. That's what we heard. I saw my first opera when I was 7. She couldn't wait to take me. It was an art form that absolutely, the sound of the human voice just drove her crazy. She loved it so. I corresponded with Lily Pons when I was 7 years old, and I wrote a letter to Elizabeth Rethberg and Ezio Pinza. I was hooked on opera.
You're one of the few singers of your generation who made a career by studying and performing in America. Were you told when you were getting started that you'd really better go to Europe if you expected to really have a singing career?
Well, yes. Actually, I received a Fulbright, which I didn't accept after going through all the business of making the tapes and presentations. There simply wasn't enough money for me to just take off and go to Europe. My mother was widowed. I had two brothers in school, becoming doctors under the GI Bill. But there was very limited funds. My mother was alone. I just felt that I was going to have to make it here. I just didn't feel I had the luxury of going abroad. And something inside me made me resent the fact that I couldn't make a living singing opera in my own country, but had to go to a country which had been severely bombed, lived through an awful war, and yet one of their first priorities was to build up their opera houses again, the conservatories, and be able to welcome young artists from every country. Here I was in the richest country in the world, and yet there was absolutely no thought to building up the world of arts here. We just went merrily on our way, importing and importing and importing.
You didn't sing at the Met until 1975.
Right.
Why do you think it took them that long to invite you to sing there? Do you think it had to do with your lack of European
performance? No, it had to do with Rudolph Bing, period. Mm-hmm. I said that I would never sing at the Met until Mr. Bing retired. And the day after he retired, I signed the contract with Gendler, and that was that.
What was it between you and he?
Well, it started out, of course, with the idea that he really didn't feel that the American artist could add to the prestige of the Metropolitan Opera. It is true that he was there in glorious times when there was Tubaldi and Delmonico and Corelli and Bastianini and, you know, so who needed the American? He had a great wealth of European artists to choose from. He also wrote a book about me, and about me he wrote, "How could a girl from Brooklyn know anything about singing the Queens of Donizetti?" It's interesting. Why should a girl from Brooklyn know less than, let's say, a lady from Spain? Or, I mean, English queens are English queens. It was just an attitude he had. We have since, you know, become very close friends. He had a radio program and invited me to go on it, which I thought took a lot of courage on his part. And we found we had same kind of humor. And he announced on the radio that I was his biggest mistake, and that his greatest regret was not that I didn't sing at the Met because I proved that I didn't need the Met, but that we could have been friends for 20 years and that he regrets.
One of the turning points in your career was when you sang the role of Cleopatra in Julius Caesar, and it was critically acclaimed.
Yeah, that was the turning point.
Now, you had told Julius Riddell, the head of the New York City Opera, that if he hired someone outside the company for the role of Cleopatra, as he had been considering doing, that you were going to quit.
Yes.
Did it ever dawn on you that he might have said, well, then goodbye?
Yes. He said to me, you're not going to quit. I said, yes, I am. Well, he said, how will that accomplish your singing Cleopatra? And I said, I will do my first New York recital at Carnegie Hall. Peter, my husband, has offered to give it to me as a present. And I will sing all five of the Cleopatra arias that are in your version. And he burst out laughing. I said to him, Julius, take someone inside the company, not me, and I won't open my mouth. But going outside implies there's nobody within who can do it. And that simply isn't true. And it's just too demeaning. I'll never fight you on taking another soprano who's with us. That's you're the director of the company. You're supposed to take the one that you feel does it best. But to go outside means there's nobody here who can do it. And that's just a lie. So I don't accept it.
Had you ever done anything like that before?
No.
Give an ultimatum like that?
No, but you understand, in 1966, I was already 37 years old. I wasn't a young singer. In the past, when I had first begun, I didn't have financial security. It was hard for me to walk away from any job that paid me anything. I was a married woman. My husband was a very successful businessman, and it didn't worry me that I might not have enough money. My mother was cared for. Both my brothers were doctors already. So, you know, life was moving on. And singing was not the be-all and end-all in my life. I had my husband and my family. I had a very good life outside of the opera house, so I didn't feel desperate. And I was never terribly ambitious. I never dreamed this career would happen. I wanted to sing because I loved to sing. I really did. I couldn't wait to get to the theater to sing. But, you know, when people say to me today, don't you miss performing? No, I don't miss performing. I miss singing terribly. But I don't miss getting up on the stage at all. I miss my coach from 9 to 11 every morning and the new literature and the cracking of a score for the first time and seeing what I could do with it. I miss that a lot, but I don't miss the performing. And so when I made that ultimatum, I made it with the idea that, yes, he could say, look, that's my decision. I also made it from a very secure feeling of knowing that at that moment I was doing all the parts in Hoffmann for him, Donna Anna, the Queen of the Night, Constanza, and the Abduction from the Seraglio. You don't replace me that easily. You have somebody who every fourth night can walk in and do four of the most difficult things in the repertoire. You don't just dismiss her lightly. And coming up were a tremendous number of projects that required my capabilities, such as they were, and he knew it.
Now that you're in the position that he was in when you gave him that ultimatum, how would you feel if somebody came up to you and said, if you hire out for a role or if you hire this person for a role, I'm going to leave the company? How would you handle it?
It's happened, and I've acquiesced.
Really?
Yes. Because it was brought to my attention that I was doing precisely that and that there was somebody who could do this. And I said that I wasn't aware that somebody could do it. And if they would be willing to stand on the stage and audition it for me, I would have auditioned it for Julius. If he had said to me, all right, let me hear you sing two of the arias, I would have gladly done it. And in this particular case, I said, okay, I'd like to hear it. And it was done, and done beautifully. And so I left it that way. But in the case of the Cleopatra, it was the opening night of the new theater, the opening night of its first grand opera season. I felt I had stuck with the company. I'd been with it 11 years at that point. I just felt that opening night should have been mine, particularly since the role was made for my voice.
Do you think you sang especially well that first night?
Yes, I think I did. I think the excitement caught on. I think Tregel and I were at our very, very best. We really, I looked up at one point and I thought, my God, he's a singing Gielgud. You know, it was an extraordinary moment. I think that opening night, nobody could have touched us.
You took time off early in your career to have children.
Mm-hmm.
How did you time that? I mean, did you time it so that you knew at a certain point in your career you'd want to leave and take the time out for children?
Well, yes. When I got married, I tried to have children right off. It just took me a little while before that happened. We were married in 56, and my first child was born in 59, but I wanted a family immediately. It just didn't happen to work out that way for some reason. Then all of a sudden, I had two children in less than 2 years. But my career was not going anyplace, really. Nobody knew who I was, so it didn't seem to matter that I absented myself. Nothing really took place until the Cleopatra. Then what I did seemed to make a difference to the musical world.
You had two children, and your daughter was born deaf, and your son was born retarded. Did you think that it would be difficult for you to start singing again, to start performing again after that?
Probably. I didn't think about it at all. I must say that the problems were enormous enough for me to think that I would have to see that these children were educated to their full potential. So Muffy and I went to school together for years. I did the best I could with the boy to let him develop to his full potential. I kept him home till he was about 7 or 8 years old, and then it was no longer possible to do that. And so he's been in a lovely private school with people that take very good care of him, and he's learned now the sign language, so we're even able to communicate with him, which we never were before. But as I said, it was not an important career, nor was the career important to me. So I never thought, oh, shucks, there goes that career. These were monumental problems, and the career was really rather an important item in my life.
What did you return then?
Therapy, I think. My husband decided that he would give me 52 round-trip tickets between Boston and New York so that I could go in, resume my singing lessons, see my mother. My whole family lived in New York. Still does. And have a means of escape.
You've said that the experience of being a mother gave you an inner strength that you think was communicated through your singing when you were on stage.
Yes, I do. I think having survived what I did with my children, other things became very unimportant. It really was no longer a question of my having to please everybody. Everybody didn't have to like me. It became this idea that I enjoyed singing, and I just wanted to communicate that good time. I was out for having a good time. I felt God owed me a little bit. So it seemed to be most rewarding when I was singing. And what happened was I went to bed one night with one voice and woke up with another that was so sensational everybody dropped dead to hear it. I think I woke up with a different attitude. And the attitude was, this is the very best I can do, and I love doing it. If you don't like it, fine. There's no problem with that. And I think that freed me into being a much more creative singer, a much more improvisational actress on the stage. I took risks because I figured no matter what terrible things happened to me, I had already lived through something more terrible. I gave every performance. When I was finished, I had nothing left. I wrung it dry. If it wasn't enough, tough. It was enough for me.
You were actually a prodigy when you were young, and you sang in commercials and on radio broadcasts when you were like six, right?
Yeah.
Did that make you approval-oriented? Because I think when you're really young and you don't have any standards of your own, you don't know what you're being measured against, that you rely on the judgment of adults to let you know if you're good or not.
You bet. That's one of the most damaging aspects of child performers, in that there is no capability of self-analysis as there is as an adult. When I finished a performance, I used to lock the door as soon as I got back in my dressing room, still in costume, still sweaty, take my score and mark in yellow, I mean something that you couldn't erase, yellow laundry marker or whatever those things are, all the places I missed. Everything that I had set out to do a certain thing and missed it. And I never changed the yellow until I could mark it out in black that I had accomplished it. I did that after my scores are a disaster if you see them. That's why people say, who are you going to leave your scores to the garbage pail? You can't read anything in it. But I told myself when I did well, and I told myself when I did poorly, after that nothing else mattered. It had to be my own analysis. Because when your career goes nuts, as mine did, there's always someone to come back and tell you how wonderful you were when you know perfectly well it was a lousy night. And there's always somebody to come back and tell you how lousy you were when you know that you had just accomplished something really remarkably well. In terms of a child performer, you don't have that capability, so you're doing everything for approval.
Some performers, when they grew up in a place like Brooklyn, right, you're living in a Jewish middle-class Brooklyn neighborhood. Mm-hmm. When you started going out in the world and performing on your own, did you try to act as if you were from someplace else?
No, you know the old saying, you can take the girl out of Brooklyn, you can't take Brooklyn out of the girl. I was a street kid. I never wanted to be from someplace else. I just wanted to be an opera star. I didn't want to be an opera star who forgot where she came from. I've never denied where I came from. I am a Jewish woman. I'm very proud of my heritage, very proud.
How did you change your name from Belle Silverman to Beverly Sills?
A movie producer did that by the name of Walter Wanger. When I turned 7, Shirley Temple turned 8. He wanted to have the Shirley Temple with the opera voice. And he said, there's just no way we can do a Belle Silverman on a marquee. And he was the one who put it into Beverly Sills. It was an era when they were making up names. For a while, I was Vicki Lynn, if you please. That was even worse. You like that one?
Great.
Yes, that came out of a blouse label. So
sounds like a chorus line girl.
Yeah, precisely. So the Beverly Sills just started at such a young age that I sort of got stuck with it. It was kind of fun having it to pretend you were somebody else when you were a kid. That was fun.
Throughout your career in opera, you have been known as not only an excellent singer, but as an excellent actress as well. And it seems that not everybody who performs on stage in opera is as interested in the acting part as they are in the singing part. And I'd really like for you to tell a story that you relay in your memoir about working with Pavarotti and your fear that after he took an aria, he was going to bow and like break with the role momentarily, and you didn't want that to happen.
No, well, you know, we had different training, really. When you grow up with the New York City Opera, which is a repertory company, you find yourself playing cameo roles one night and 4 nights later you're the leading lady. So there really isn't time to think about curtain calls and bows. Luciano is a very warm individual. That's not a play that he acts out when he's on stage. I think the hanky came later, but the ebullience and the outpouring comes from the man himself. And it is a kind of love affair he has with the public. And when they applaud a lot, he just likes to acknowledge and say thank you right away. I did go to see him and beg him not to do that. And I said to him, you know, everything we do will bring the house down if we do it well, because Bellini is one showstopper after another. And it's disconcerting, and I got that crazy mad scene coming up. I've got to start the character right from the beginning, and she's such a elusive girl anyhow. It's not like Lucia that is, you know, builds to a terrific, terrific madness. This is just kind of wacky. And I said to him, you know, let's not bow, and he said, I can promise. And we had this big duet ending in a great big embrace with our heads in each other's necks, sort of. And the house came down, and suddenly they were still applauding, and he said to me, one little bow, Bevelina. And I said, no. So he bit me in the neck, and of course I pulled back, and there we were. It certainly looked to the audience as if we were bowing. But on the other hand, he and I did a Lucia in San Francisco, which it's one of the few times the reviewers, the press, and Luciano and I agreed all at once that it was a kind of historic performance. Certainly neither one of us felt we'd ever sung Lucia like that or performed it like that. And we were in total agreement on the staging, total. We didn't have a single problem with acknowledging anything we had gotten so engrossed in this concept of it, which humanized these two young people to the degree that he agreed not to do anything except play Edgardo, which he did. And it was, I think, a history-making performance for the two of us.
Are there any conventions in opera that you think are really pretensions of opera that you'd like to see stripped away, like the hanky, for instance?
Yes. Yeah, I'd like to see all pretensions in opera stripped away. I'd like to see a much more naturalistic approach to the acting. Corelli had it. He knew how to lean back against the wall and sing the third act aria in Tosca just by putting his hands in his pockets. I hate operatic poses. I think we shouldn't be afraid to turn our backs on the audience while we're singing, if it's a natural movement to make. I think we shouldn't hesitate to sing an ugly tone if the word we're saying is an ugly one that should be spit out and not prettily voiced. I'd like to see a lot of the chorus lineups. I'd like to have each chorus person feel they have a part to play. Capobianco's a genius at that. When we did Manon, for instance, every chorus person had a task. One was the goose person who was coming in to market his geese. In this case, it's goose. One would be a vendor of feathers. Everybody had a part to play. So you never saw a chorus lineup. And I'd like to see lighting much more naturalistic. If it's a hot summer Mediterranean day, I'd like you to feel that the people are sweaty. I want to erase all the artificiality of opera. I would like people to be intellectually and emotionally touched by the performance they've seen as well as moved by the performance they've heard. It's a given that I'd like to have beautiful singing. I mean, there is no opera without a beautiful voice. But for me, that's only about 60% of the evening. The other 40 is to touch me emotionally and intellectually.
After your performance is through, there's always fans waiting backstage, right, who want to meet the singers. Were you ever concerned about the way a fan was behaving? Did you ever find yourself calling the police?
Yes.
about a weird fan?
Yeah. Cheryl Milnes and I had, I got the life-threatening letter.
Really?
But it involved both of us because we were doing Thais. She, of course, is a fallen woman, as we say, and he is a priest who comes to convert her. And in the process, she seduces him and then becomes a nun. That's a very quick and inaccurate sum up of Thais. And there was one man who wrote me that because we were both so immoral, he was coming to the performance to kill me. I called the Met, talked to Tony Bliss about it, and he said, look, I think you should cancel and let your cover go on. And I said, no, then I'll have to give in to every kook. Then he'll write me every single time. We just can't give in to these nuts. The only thing I'd like is extra security at the stage door and at all the entrances and in the rings at each fire exit. I'd like to have a security officer. And they agreed, so they called Lincoln Center and got all the extra security guards. And when I came out, you could see it. Cheryl, I'm so nearsighted, I barely make it to the conductor. But Cheryl said, my God, look at the badges. You can see them shining. And you could because, you know, the exits are lit, all the fire exits. And there were policemen all over the place. And I think the man saw that. And so the performance went on as scheduled. And when the performance was over, Kitty Carlisle was coming to see me, and I was bringing her and some of the members of the cast home for a little supper afterward. And she came, picked me up, and Charlie Rica was escorting both of us. He's one of the men on the staff, the managerial staff of the Met, escorting both of us because he was aware of the threat, to my car. As we hit the switchboard, there is a little anteroom where they do not allow fans in who are not on your list. Uh, And there he was, and he started to shriek obscenities at me, and he was obviously drugged, and, I mean, his eyes were wild, and he was a very attractive man and well-dressed. He was just disheveled. He was a mess, screaming at me. And, of course, the two policemen carried me up literally off our feet, dumped us in the car, actually knocked me to the floor of the car, and yelled at my driver, "Get going." And we looked out the back window, and the man was just taken away. I saw him again months later, but he was very well behaved. And I don't know what happened to him. I never asked. He just gone. The funny incident that happened is the Siege of Corinth. When I came out for a solo bow, a man hopped up on the stage. I don't know how he climbed over the orchestra railing, hopped up, had a record album, and said, "I have to catch my train before midnight. Would you please sign this? I can't wait to go backstage." On stage in front of, 4,000 people, and I signed it. And Tommy Shippers yelled off stage, "You're crazy, you're crazy. What are you doing?" I didn't know what else to do. I signed it. The man went right back, crossed the banister, took off into his home again. That was a real nut.
Have you felt vulnerable in general?
I don't think performers can think about it. Opera audiences are, apart from the Brava Diva, that's the most rambunctious group there is, and they're a nice group. They just love to make the noise, and we like to hear that noise. But no, I think it's a rarity that you get that in opera.
You haven't sung in public since 1980. When did you know that it was time to retire, that you wanted to retire from singing?
Well, I'd made a conscious decision to retire when I was 50. My husband and I had agreed to that. And I would have made it at 50, except John Colomanati was writing an opera for me called La Loca. And as is usual with John Colo, he was not on time. And so it didn't get premiered until my 51st birthday. And that was the last opera role I did in public. It was something my husband and I had discussed. He felt that a 50-year-old singer was old enough. I wanted to get out while people were saying, "Oh, it's much too soon," rather than "it's much too late. When is she ever going to quit?"
When you look back on your career in music now from the vantage point of being the director of the New York City Opera, are there any things that you really wish you could have done differently or want to change?
Nothing. There isn't even a role I left undone. It's funny. I would have perhaps liked to have sung more in Europe, but with my children, that was impossible to put so much distance between us. Other than that, can't think of a single thing I'd have done differently.
Opera singer Beverly Sills, who is now the general director of the New York City Opera. I hope you enjoyed this edition of Fresh Air. Fresh Air is produced at WHYY Radio in Philadelphia. Engineering today's show was Joyce Lieberman. Fresh Air is edited by associate producer Maeve Magoran and co-produced by Danny Miller and me. My name's Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. National distribution of Fresh Air is made possible by support from the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia and its 16 undergraduate, graduate, and professional schools. Additional funding comes from National Public Radio member stations and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.